Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with my partner, Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, or just through restaurantguysradio.com.
And you can also receive our podcast. We're on iTunes and Podcast Alley and all those other cool podcasting websites. And you can. We've also just gone on to Yahoo, has launched a podcasting site.
We're there. We're there.
And if you're listening to us on the podcast, please email us to all your friends. We're up to about 30,000 of you out there now. Thank you. We love you. Please, we want more. This is really great. We're getting such great emails from you all. Thank you very, very much for them, and thank you for supporting us in what we do. We have some strong ideas about what we're doing.
Those of you who listen to us all the time may not have noticed. Francis and I have some opinions.
And, well, you know, whether you agree or disagree, it's nice to have a discussion about them, especially since, well, we've got the microphones and we can't hear what you have to say.
You know, one of the things that I have a strong, strong opinion on?
What's that?
When I look at a restaurant menu and I know it's a bunch of malarkey.
You're liars. You're liars. We went out to dinner recently and we looked at a restaurant menu and we thought, oh my God, they're lying about everything.
Just shameful.
What was the fish?
I'll tell you that we went to a restaurant recently and they said, we have Alaskan King salmon.
Except I was in the fish market the night before.
Okay, there's no Alaskan King salmon.
It's out of season.
Right now. It's out of season. You really can't. I mean, maybe there are 100 fish in the Northeast.
And you don't have one.
Okay, and you don't have. And the place we were at didn't have one. So I asked the question because I didn't want to jump to a conclusion. I said, well, is this fish frozen?
Did you? No, sir. It is very fresh.
We would never freeze the fish. This would be no good for the fish.
This would be no. And that's exactly how he said it.
So now it could be California King salmon. There's some California King salmon available right now, but there isn't Alaskan King salmon.
Right. Well, and the California King salmon is about half the price of what you would if it were available. We tried to price. It's fraud.
I just get so mad.
Excuse me, waiter. Your pants are on fire.
You know, and there was an article.
Captain.
There was an article in the Times 6 months ago about all this fraudulent fish being in the marketplace. Well, even if they didn't buy fraudulent fish, They're telling you that it's something that it's not, and I just can't stand it. It gives restaurants a bad name, it gives restaurateurs a bad name, and it gives waiters a bad name. Stop it.
And you know what? We care so deeply about food, and you know what? Alaskan King salmon is very, very special, and it's worth the $35 an entree you're going to have to pay for it.
Right. That fish is $12 a pound with bones and head on, and it comes out to $24 a pound by the time you clean it up, or $20.
So, and the other thing that does is that when somebody tries to really serve Alaskan King salmon, which is good for Native Americans, it's good for it's a beautiful piece of fish, it's good for the diner, and you go to a restaurant and they say, oh, well, our Alaskan King salmon is $35. Like, ah, I went to that other restaurant and it was, and it wasn't very good, but it was only $20.
And Alaskan King salmon tastes like no other salmon. Fresh Alaskan King salmon tastes like no farm-raised salmon. It tastes like no, or even the organic salmons. It doesn't taste like that at all. It is its own special entity that I want you to try for real from somebody who really means it, but you need to try it in season.
Same restaurant. Lies continue. Beluga caviar, 1 ounce, $55.
Well, that's possible. That's possible if they're losing $150 an ounce. Every time you buy the beluga caviar from them, it costs them $150.
As my nephew used to say when he was 2 years old, I don't think so. Beluga caviar is not, you can't, it's not possible, you know? And we need to be educated.
It can be one of two things. The owner of the restaurant can be buying counterfeit product, which is possible, but then the owner is not smart enough to be serving beluga caviar. Okay?
You've got to be smarter.
Because if you're buying if someone tries to sell you a diamond and it's $18,
right.
Do you think it's a real diamond?
And you as the consumer may not know, but you know what? The restaurateur has a responsibility
to know
what he's serving.
They need to know.
So either he's a liar.
Sources.
Either he's lying or he's wrong. Either answer is unacceptable.
Right.
You know, either he's lying on purpose or he's been deceived, and he's deceiving you by mistake, and that's not
acceptable. And there is American sturgeon caviar.
It's very good.
And there are some other caviars coming from the United States now that are extraordinary.
Even the American sturgeon is going to cost $100 in a restaurant.
Right.
So I don't know what is black lumpfish caviar, is what the guy's saying. Anyway, and there's nothing wrong with black lumpfish caviar.
And again, one of the reasons that Francis and I have avoided serving beluga caviar in our restaurant is there is a lot of counterfeit beluga caviar out there. But it costs, on a wholesale level, somewhere between $100 and $200 an ounce, sometimes as much as $300 an ounce. So even the counterfeit stuff is very expensive.
Next topic was Dover sole for $24 a person. I don't think so.
I don't think so. That ain't coming from Dover.
Dover is a place. It's in England, okay?
You know
and they fish for a sole there.
You know what you can get for $24 a person? A lonesome sole.
Exactly.
You cannot get Dover sole.
Lemon sole, Raritan River sole. And you know what? You can get some good fish. And look, there's nothing wrong with serving inexpensive fish.
Absolutely.
But when you go to a restaurant and you see these things that are too good to be true, sadly, very often they are. And in New Jersey, this happens a lot. It's like, the Dover sole, sir. I'm like, yeah, you know, it's not Dover sole. And what that does is it makes it harder for the guy. He says, you know what? I got these Dover soles. I got to charge $40 a person for a Dover sole for two. But you know what? I want to bring that to my customers.
Because it is special.
And he can't.
Because real Dover sole that's never been frozen and is perfect in pristine condition is its own very special, very delicate, delicious treat.
That we occasionally find at the fish market. That we've gone and bought like below wholesale ourselves at the fish market, and it still costs us more than he was charging.
Absolutely. I ask you, if it's too good to be true, don't buy it. You know, what other things are too good to be true that we see on menus all the time?
Fresh rack of lamb.
Rack of lamb at $18, $19, $20, $22.
I was in the city of Newark the other day, and I got a rack of lamb for $19, and it was the whole rack, and they told me it hadn't been frozen. It, of course, had been frozen.
Of course.
It was the whole rack, and I got the whole rack, $19. Like, what, did this fall off a truck?
Right. Well,
you know?
Well, and at least that was really lamb. Okay, the Dover sole and the beluga caviar are not Dover sole, and they're not beluga caviar, and it's not Alaskan king salmon. At least this is really lamb. But it's frozen lamb, and it's inferior quality lamb. And if it's $19, it's lower than the quality lamb than you're buying in ShopRite.
No, but here's the deal. For $19 in this restaurant, which was a nice restaurant, I had a nice bottle of Spanish wine. I enjoyed it, and it was a good price, and it was a fair price for a frozen rack of lamb.
Exactly.
And I knew when I ordered it that it wasn't fresh, because a fresh rack of lamb from a good producer will cost you $12 or $13.
For a half rack. So you can expect that would cost the restaurant to do a full rack of premium quality lamb that's not frozen about $24.
Right. So they got to charge like $50 to take a
beating. To do anything else before you've cooked it, before you've had someone clean it, anything.
But here's the point. I didn't mind paying $19 for the rack of lamb.
Sure, it was worth it. It was totally worth it, I'm sure.
The problem is that they've fooled someone who's a consumer who doesn't know that there's anything better out there, who then, you know, they go to five restaurants like that, and then they come into our place, or they go into another reputable place, and they say, oh, well, I have fresh rack of Colorado lamb, and it's a four-chop rack, and it's $35, and they say, well, that's ridiculous.
But
I was
at
the, you know, wherever.
They say that until they try it, and they're like, wow, why is your lamb so much better than those other places?
Yeah.
And the answer is because it's a higher quality to start with, and it's never been frozen. And you and I both know, and so do most of our listeners out there, freezing meat causes the meat to degenerate. There's really no getting around it. Yes, we all have to freeze meat at certain times in our lives, but there's no way, there's no getting around it. It causes inferior product.
And those of you who listen to the show for long enough realize that Mark and I love to go out for a burger or a dog or a cheap cut of meat, or you know, we go out for casual meals, and that's fine.
It's just fine.
That we need to be honest, and the restaurateur has a responsibility to know what he or she is serving and to be honest with you about it.
Don't lie to me.
And that's all we have to say on the matter. Hey, listen, we have a guest coming up. Our guest is going to talk to us about beer. Stephen Beaumont is an internationally recognized author and beer expert, and he's going to join us by telephone from Canada to talk about extreme beers, beer and food, and his new beer restaurant in downtown Toronto. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, you're back with the restaurant guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott from Stage Left Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey, soon to be Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey, and our guest today is Stephen Beaumont. Stephen is a widely traveled beer journalist with impeccable taste. He is has been documenting the world of beer, spirits, food, and travel for over a decade. He currently has 5 books to his credit, including last year's critically acclaimed Premium Beer Drinker's Guide and the all-new Great Canadian Beer Guide. He has his own restaurant called the Beer Bistro in Toronto, and he joins us from his home in Canada today. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Being a beer expert sounds like a pretty fun job.
Yeah, you know, it has its definite benefits. For example, I get to
drink beer.
Sit around my office and drink beer and get paid for it.
Oh, come on.
If only it were that easy, man. We know better.
In our partnership, Mark is the beer guy and I'm more the wine guy, although we both do each other's jobs. And you guys, everybody knows wine's better than beer. Come on.
Oh, stop.
Whoa.
It.
Wait a second.
Do you other beverages too, or are you just strictly beer and beer alone?
Oh, no, I'm a taste guy. So, I've got, in my dining room, I've got my beer fridge, I've got my wine fridge, and I've got my spirits cabinet.
I like you.
Covers everything.
You invite me once, I'm coming over.
How'd you get involved in all this beer stuff?
Actually, I've been doing it for about 15 years now, and it was a niche that needed to be filled in my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I was already established as a writer, doing freelance stuff, and beer has been a passion of mine since my first beer, which was sometime around the age of 11 or 12.
Mm-hmm.
You must have been in Europe where it was legal, I'm sure.
I was in Montreal.
There you go.
Where they have very strict rules on drinking as if you can put the money on the counter, you're supposed to drink. But seriously, I grew up in a household where my parents had good attitudes towards alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I was given some watered down wine when I was a kid. I was allowed to try beer from my father's glass, things like that. And for me, when I got older, this was a niche that wasn't being filled. I was the first national columnist to cover beer in Canada,
mm-hmm.
For the largest circulation in the country, paper in the country. So that's where I got started, and I just kind of went from there.
Yeah. So I was lucky enough to be in a household where I was able to do the same things and taste at a young age and not be afraid to have those things on the table. And I think the idea that my parents had with that was that I wouldn't become obsessed with it. Uh-oh.
I actually grew up in a house where my dad was a fireman. And his part-time job was to drive a truck for Rheingold Brewing Company. And so in the afternoons, it would either be a beer truck or a fire chief's car parked in my driveway for lunch.
Either way, it was cool.
Yeah, either way, I was the coolest kid on the block. That's exactly correct. So now, talk to us about, do you have a particular love for Canadian beer? Is there any chauvinistic pride in Canadian beer that you carry?
I am completely non-nationalistic. I like good beer as opposed to bad beer.
Mm-hmm.
If that beer happens to come from Canada, that's fabulous. If it happens to come from the States, I'm just as happy. If it comes from Sri Lanka, the Lion Stout from Sri Lanka, which
mm-hmm.
is a spectacular strong stout, I'm as happy for that as well. I don't believe in nationalism when it comes to taste.
Well, talk to us about Canadian beer, though. What's going on in Canada?
What's going on in Canada? Well, Canada's a pretty big place, and like the U.S., things get divided up very strongly on a regional basis. But the three main beer centers in the country are not surprisingly the three main population centers,
mm-hmm.
that being Quebec around Montreal,
sure.
Ontario around Toronto, and B.C. around Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And Victoria, I should add, in B.C. The most interesting place in Canada for beer, and it's actually one of the most interesting places in North America for beer, is Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
Montrealers, that European ethic that you get in Montreal, they have such a great affinity towards new flavors, new ideas, and they have some of the most creative brewing going on in Montreal.
Well, many of our listeners may not realize that I was actually born in Montreal, and spent the first few years of my life up north of the border, as it were. But, some of the beers that we carry, the Canadian beers, are made by a brewery called Unibrew, which I think are making some pretty interesting beers for as far as the relatively mass market go. I mean, obviously not mass market like Molson or beers like that, but so one of the larger small houses, we'll call them. I think.
What are your thoughts on Unibrew?
I think Unibrew is a tremendous brewery. Incidentally, I was born and raised in Montreal as well, and this is not kind of local patriotism that I say that Montreal is such a great beer city.
Mm-hmm.
Unibrew is at the kind of more common or more public end of the Montreal wedge.
Right.
And I, you know, things like their Terrible, which mm-hmm. I suppose in the States you'd pronounce as terrible, is one of these spectacular beers that just was an instant classic the minute mm-hmm. they brought it out. Their Modit is a tremendous beer.
Modit is probably my favorite of all the beers that they make.
Well, you know, just so everyone knows, we're talking about Unibrew is a brewery up in Canada that they make some really fabulous beer. They have a whole different line of beers, and we're going to put Unibrew up on our website later on, as well as links to Stephen Beaumont's books. He's an expert on beer who joins us today to talk about not just Canadian beer, but beer around the world, beer and food, and the movement of extreme beers, on which he's written a very good article recently. And we'll be talking with him more about that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:25. You know, Mark and I are always saying that long-term good environmental policy and good economic policy are one and the same. And that's not just for the government, it's also for small business and homeowners just like you. To help us put our money where our mouth is, we called E2ECTA. E2ECTA uses a team of specialists to find practical ways for your business or home to conserve energy and even to generate green energy that the utility company then has to buy back from you. That generates a different kind of green for your bottom line. We've gone solar at our restaurants. We're now producing cheap, non-polluting electricity, and with the help of E2ECTA, we did it for very little money. The government programs available to get you set up are unbelievable. We're talking about grants here, not loans, but grants. E2ECTA will help you find the right programs for you, and they'll do the paperwork. You keep the profits. It's a no-brainer, people. For lower energy usage, more profits for yourself, call E2ECTA at 908-359-9300 or click on their link at restaurantguysradio.com. E2ECTA for total energy solutions. Hey, you're back with the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Stephen Beaumont. Stephen Beaumont is one of the most educated people on beer and one of the best beer writers. He joins us from his home in Canada today to talk about beer in general. And we're going to talk about beers from around the world. We're going to talk about some American beers and the movement of extreme beer a little bit later in the show. But let's talk about Canadian beer because, I mean, who better than you to talk with us about Canadian beer? We talked about Unibrew, which is a fairly large for small breweries, small brewery. What are some of the other things that are going on in Canada with small producers we may not have heard of here in the States and we can go look for?
Well, you know, you can get a good overview of what's happening in two major centers in Canada by going to two great beer festivals. In Montreal in June, they have the Mondial de la Bière.
Mm-hmm.
That is an absolutely spectacular beer festival featuring a remarkable number of different
And these are all Canadian beers?
Canadian, you get some stuff from Ontario, you get a lot of stuff up from the States, actually, a lot of stuff in from Belgium and Europe, and you also get the opportunity to experience the Montreal scene as well,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, brew pubs like Dieu du Ciel, which
sure.
is God in Heaven, and it's one of the most experimental brew pubs you're going to come across anywhere.
A lot of people in the United States also don't realize that Montreal is a spectacular restaurant city. One of the absolute top three or four restaurant cities in the Northeast and very, very European in its feel as far as restaurants go.
Absolutely. The other beer festival that's worth mentioning is the Great Canadian Beer Festival, which is held in the fall. In fact, I was just there about a month ago
mm-hmm.
In Victoria, British Columbia on Vancouver Island. And that has really established itself as a great young festival
mm-hmm.
And probably the central place for cask-conditioned ale in North America. About a quarter of the 150 or so beers that were on offer this year were available as cask-conditioned ales, which, of course, is a very British
right.
style of ale.
Why don't you tell people what cask-conditioned ales are, Stephen?
Basically, it means that the ale's gone through its final fermentation in the barrel
mm-hmm.
from which it's poured, and there's no extra gas.
Right.
So you don't get this fizzy, ultra-carbonated beer you get from a normal draft. You get a much softer carbonation. It's usually poured a little warmer, you know, closer mm-hmm. to, say, 50 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. So you have a cellar temperature beer with lower carbonation and just full of flavor.
And because that fermentation the beer gets finished in the keg, you really get a special product.
And it's also kind of expensive to bring to you because those beers are very, very fragile. And when we come back from the break, we're going to tell you some places locally where you can get some cask-conditioned beer brought to you in beer engines, which is pretty interesting. Our guest today is Stephen Beaumont. He's a beer expert. We're going to be talking more with him in just a moment after the news. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon or just through restaurantguysradio.com.
Our guest today is Stephen Beaumont. Stephen is a widely traveled beer journalist with impeccable taste. He's the author, he's been documenting beer, spirits, food, and travel for over a decade. He currently has 5 books to his credit, including last year's critically acclaimed Premium Beer Drinker's Guide and the all-new Great Canadian Beer Guide. He also has his own restaurant in Canada based on beer, and we're going to be talking about that in just a moment. Before the news, Stephen, we were talking about cask-conditioned ales, which are ales that are finished in the barrel, mm-hmm. and have a tremendous amount of flavor, less fizz, are usually served warm. They take a lot more care for the publican, for the barman to bring one of these to you. That's why we don't see them very often. Can you tell us what a bar has to do to be able to offer these things to you?
Well, they most breweries nowadays, when they're dealing with cask conditioned ale, will do that final fining, which mm-hmm. is where they add the substance, and there are various substances that will take the yeast down to the bottom of the barrel,
mm-hmm.
And they'll set that up for the pub or the bar that's serving them. But all the same, you know, it means finishing these barrels within 3 or 4 days.
Yep.
It means having a bartender who knows how to pour them properly.
Just to elaborate a little bit, we're talking about, it's like, you know, you open a bottle of wine, you got a few days to drink it. You open one of these kegs of beer, and you've got a few days to drink it. And during those few days, it's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
It's also phenomenally expensive, so you've got to have a clientele that's willing to pay for it. And it can't be brought up in a traditional beer system, which depends on the pressure of carbonation. It's brought up by a pump, a very clean, sterile pump system called a beer engine. And these things are amazing to watch. And if you ever, and a place locally, if you're listening in the greater New York area, my favorite place to go get cask-conditioned ale is a place called DBA on First Avenue in Manhattan. And they always have a couple of cask-conditioned ales, and it's really amazing stuff.
You took the words right out of my mouth. DBA is one of my favorite bars.
It's
all the way from Canada. He comes from Canada. You can go from New Jersey to New York to DBA. Isn't that a great place?
Yeah,
it is a great place.
Really,
the other, another one which is worth mentioning is Blind Tiger down in the Village.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Irish people, thank you. Irish people open on that. Thank you very much.
Oh, golly.
So, a little nepotism on my part. Never hurt anybody.
Well, one of the things that I was hoping to get into, Stephen, just for a moment or two, is ageability of beers. And what some people don't realize with this whole born-on dating thing that was put out a few years ago is there are beers out there that get better with age as opposed to get worse with age. Can we talk about that for just a second?
Absolutely. You know, I mentioned earlier on in the show my wine fridge, which is also mm-hmm. where I keep some of my Belgians that I'm putting a few years on.
Mm-hmm.
Belgian beers, not actual Belgian people in there.
No.
Oh, okay. Good. Okay, just
that's
checking.
That's stowaways from my last trip.
Okay.
But, you know, I've got 10, 15-year-old bottles in that
mm-hmm.
thing. And these are beers that, you know, some of them, like I've got a 10-year-old Cantillon, which is a classic of the Lambic style from Belgium. Very dry, tart, champagne-like beers, totally unlike anything that you find anywhere else in the world. This thing's 10 years old. I'll probably put another 7, 8, 9 years on it before I even think about opening it.
What makes a beer ageable?
There are a few things. I would say definitely strength is important.
Mm-hmm. Alcohol is a preservative as well as, you know, all its other functions.
The two big things in beer for the cellar is you're looking at hops
mm-hmm.
and alcohol, and both are preservatives.
Mm-hmm.
The third preservative, which is actually a little controversial as a preservative factor, is yeast.
Mm-hmm.
So beers with yeast in the bottles, are thought of as better agers than others. Now, I've heard opinions expressed recently that yeast actually has nothing to do with the ageability of a beer, but to my experience, I would say that it does.
Yeah, from what I've from the beers that I've seen, the ones that are that have a little bit of yeast in the bottle seem to do a little better. Although that kind of as the older the beer gets, I think the less important that gets. One of the things that I want to tell everybody is if you're looking for a beer to age and you don't see anybody that you can talk to, look for those champagne corks in the top of the bottle, because that's a good clue. A lot of times people will put those corks on the bottle in order to help better preserve the beer for a longer period of time.
And this, I think, is important point to make. Stand those bottles up.
Right.
Don't lie them down. Or if you're going to keep them for 10 years, lie them down for about 1 month out of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't want extended contact with any beer cork, because brewers always get the worst cork out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more likely to be corked than mm-hmm. an equivalent wine.
Okay, beer geeks. I'm sorry, I was nodding off over here.
We can't help it. We like beer.
It's my own show.
Oh, by the way, if for everybody in our audience who's never had an aged or ageable beer, they are spectacular. There's one out, very mass marketed right now, certainly in the Northeast, a beer called Chimay, a Belgian beer, which is ageable, and you can age it for a few years, and those really, really get spectacular. And what happens is they have kind of high acidity levels when they're very young, and that's really delicious, and they get older and more creamy and richer, and that's really delicious as well.
I have to say, Mark's right. I came into this, Mark is the beer guy and I'm the wine guy, and we've really taught each other a lot over the last 13 years or so, and these ageable beers are really tremendous. Duvel is another mm-hmm. beer that you can find out there. Is there a site that people can go to, Stephen? I mean, we're going to send them to your books, and they should certainly buy your books, but is there a site that people can go to sort of get their way around, their hands around this, their arms around this?
Well, you can almost start with my site, Stephen Beaumont's World of Beer,
uh-huh.
Which is actually an online magazine I've been operating since 97.
Uh-huh.
So in terms of the Internet, I think that's like AD01 or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. That's a long time ago.
But that's worldofbeer.com, very right. simple to remember. And also, if people want to contact me directly, I can be reached through there. I answer questions through there. I help out restaurants. I do staff education for their servers on beer and all that kind
of
stuff.
We do have a lot of restaurateurs that listen and people in the business who listen to the show. And I have to say, the Belgian beers, some of these beers can be as expensive as wine, and some of them can be as fine as wine. One of the things that's very interesting, if you want to make a mark for yourself, and this goes for restaurateurs as well as for people, personally, aging beers and finding what beers are ageable. First of all, they're less expensive than, an ageable beer is the price of, an acceptable bottle of wine. You know what I mean? Whereas when you find age-worthy wine, you often have to spend a lot of money. And to put in your beer cellar beers that you keep down there for a couple of years, it's a very special thing. It's something you can find in the supermarket. Mm-hmm. And they go really well with food. Now, you have a restaurant that's focused on beer as well. Isn't that true, Stephen?
Yes, I do. It's called Beer Bistro. It's in the heart of downtown Toronto. And we do exactly that. We have a beer cellar and a special cellar list on our menu. And,
that's fun.
We've got, I think the oldest thing in our cellar right now is a 1997 Roe Gold Crustacean.
Wow.
But, we're only 2 years old, so we're still starting right now.
Yeah. Now, do you find in your restaurant, do you find you shaping the cuisine to go with beer, or are you getting different beers to go with cuisine?
Well, the primary owner of the restaurant is a very talented chef named Brian Morin, and mm-hmm. Brian is an old friend of mine. So, we taste beer together, we taste food together, we talk about, what would go best with this, we play with flavors, and he's taken beer cuisine to levels that, quite frankly, I've never even seen before, and
mm-hmm.
I travel around the world tasting beer.
Mm-hmm. We've had the good fortune to do a couple of beer dinners intermixed in with our wine dinners and cocktail dinners and all kinds of other programs that we've done, and one of the things that I've found is that for us, we've been able to not have to change the cuisine so much because there are so many different kinds of beer out there, so many different styles of beer out there that you can match them to almost any food.
I think absolutely. I mean, there is definitely a beer for every food or a food for every beer. I don't think the same can be said of wine, and I think this is where beer really comes to the fore.
You're wrong.
Well, what about salads? You know, salads are vinaigrette.
Turner Veltliner.
That really limits your choices, right?
Well, yeah.
It definitely does.
Yeah.
Limited
desserts.
I have to say.
You got a handful of wines that go with chocolate. I've got a whole cellar full of beers that go with chocolate.
No, it's true. And the whole, like, beer and wine, you know, beer and food, wine and food thing, it's a magical way to make it all go together. And I think people who love beer don't realize out there that there are great beers that you can take your love of beer even further. Our guest is Stephen Beaumont. He's an expert on beer, and we're talking with him about beer and food, and we'll be talking more with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1145.
Hi. This is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
You're back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark Pascal and Francis Schott, and we're having a great time today talking with Stephen Beaumont. Stephen is a beer expert who joins us from his home in Canada. Although he is from Canada, he is talking about beer from all over the world. And what brought Stephen to our attention and made us say, you know, we got to get this guy on the show, is you did a pretty fabulous article recently on extreme beers, which is a movement that we've watched over the years and are fascinated by. And we're talking about where wine and beer come together for a lot of the show. Why don't you tell us about extreme beers and talk to us a little bit about this article?
Well, you know, extreme beer, it's such a pithy little term to use, but you know, basically when we talk about extreme beer, we're talking about beer that ventures way, way outside the norm. And I think the Wall Street Journal, of all places, was the first time the term was really kind of brought into public use. But they were talking about, you know, simple things like fruit-flavored beers and oak-aged beers. And for crying out loud, we got beers now 18 to 25% alcohol.
Let me put that in perspective for everybody. Your average Budweiser is what, 6% alcohol?
No, the average Budweiser
Bud would be about 4.5.
Okay, so that's 4.5% alcohol. Your average bottle of wine, say if it's a Burgundy, is 12% alcohol. Maybe a big, strong Cabernet is 15. So you're talking about a beer that's 18% alcohol.
Port wine would be the same alcohol content as these beers that we're talking about.
Sam Adams Utopia is the strongest beer in the world, 25% alcohol.
Sam Adams Utopia also is probably the most expensive beer in the world.
Holy cow. And it's
a mere $100 a bottle.
Yeah, that's all. $100.
That's
$100
beer.
You get a beer.
But it's 26 ounces.
You don't even get a six-pack, though. Come on. $100. I better get a six-pack.
We're not talking about a 12-ounce bottle here. Hold on.
Now, we need to explain to everybody. Listen, what makes a beer is a beer comes from grain as the base. Wine comes from fruit as a base. Okay? So it is a beer, but it's not this utopia we're talking about. It's not carbonated anymore. It's very concentrated. It takes, I mean, is there some crazy statistic on how much grain it takes to make a bottle of that utopia?
Not that I've seen, actually. Sam, our Boston Beer Company, is very reluctant to discuss these beers, professional secrets and all this kind of stuff.
I think I did read one thing that they put out.
Sam Adams Triple had like 800 pounds of grain per case of beer or something.
Yeah,
some crazy number like that.
So,
but you know, and it goes beyond that too. There's a guy out in California, you know, you gotta mention him, Vinny Cherluzzo. And Vinny is at Russian River Brewing Company.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing stuff like he's isolating certain strains of bacteria which are used or are commonly found in lambic beers in Belgium.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like Brettanomyces and things like that?
Brettanomyces, Staphylococcus. Mm-hmm. He's using that in beers, and he's aging them in Pinot Noir barrels or Chardonnay barrels.
Stephen, I don't know if you know this, but Brettanomyces is something that winemakers are trying to get out of their barrels, not put into it.
Yeah, well,
I haven't heard this before, but Brettanomyces, which is a pathogen in wine, works well in beer?
No, not normally. Brettanomyces is commonly, it's one of the wild yeasts that wind up in lambic beers in Belgium.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it makes the beer extraordinarily dry, not extraordinarily, but very tart.
Can you just in a quick second tell everybody, all our guests, what lambic beers are from Belgium?
Lambics are a special kind of wheat beer which are fermented with wild yeast. It's the only style of commercially available beer in the world where they, instead of pitching a single strain of yeast very carefully controlled, they basically just open up all the windows and let all the yeast in the air around them ferment these beers.
So they make beer like they did 100 years ago.
And then they age them in barrels for 1 to 3 years.
Wow.
And frequently they're flavored with different fruits and things like that as well.
Yeah, and differentiation has to be made between the kind of commercial mainstream sweet lambics like Bellevue from Interbrew.
Right, right.
And traditional ones like Hansen's, Cantillon, Decam.
Traditional lambics have a very, very high notes to them. We talked about that high acidity, and that's more characteristic of a traditional lambic.
All right, Stephen,
I'm constantly relating them to champagne.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Beaumont, I got to ask you a question. Now, a lot of people drink these mass-produced beers, the Coors, the Budweiser, the Amstel, all that. Is there a place for that? Is that a good? Are those a good thing in the world, or are they a bad thing in the world?
I think, you know, these are, especially the really light-flavored beers, these are beers really for people who don't like the flavor of beer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and
funny.
There have been people who study the market who say that, you know, something like 85% of the people who drink beer don't actually like the taste of beer.
That's really too many. Drink something else.
That's a little messed up.
You know, but beer is it's a social thing, right? I call it the most sociable beverage in the world, because you don't say to somebody after work, hey, let's go out for a glass of wine. You say, let's go out for a beer.
Well, we say let's go out for a glass of wine, but
okay,
most people don't. But most people don't.
People wonder about us, though.
Just beer is its own thing. Yeah.
Hey, Stephen, we want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us all the way from your home in Canada. This has been a great hour. You've been a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun for me, and I look forward to dropping by next time I'm in Jersey.
Hey, whenever you're in Jersey, you do that. We're going to put up a link to our website to send everybody to your restaurant when they come up and visit
you.
People
want to get in touch with you, they can go to worldofbeer.com, which they can link through restaurantguysradio.com. We'll make sure we put that link up for everybody.
And you're going to be our resident beer expert, okay, Stephen?
You got it.
When we run into beer questions, we can call you for the answers?
No worries.
You rock. Thanks a lot, Stephen.
Okay, nice talking to you guys.
Take care.
Cheers.
That was Stephen Beaumont. He is a beer journalist. He has written a lot of books on beer, an article recently that we found on beer, and he is also a restaurant guy himself with a beer restaurant he has up in Toronto that we should all go visit. I hope you've enjoyed the last few minutes talking with him about beer. We're going to have a couple more stories about beer amongst ourselves in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, you're back with The Restaurant Guys. We just got off the phone with Stephen Beaumont, who's a beer expert who joined us by telephone from Canada. He wrote a great article on some extreme beers, on age-worthy beers. And we had an experience many years ago where beers were age-worthy, where we got to have some age-worthy beers. And I was so excited that I asked, I think this is about 6 years ago, I asked my partner Mark, who is a beer expert, who's been noted as an expert by Michael Jackson, the foremost beer writer in the world, as a beer expert. And I said, Mark, can you please pick me up a few cases of beer to age to put in my wine cellar?
Which I will tell you that I went out and I did. I did the right thing. He asked me to get some ageable beers for him, and I got them, and then I drank them. And then I got them again, and then I drank them again.
I've locked them up, but Mark has a key to all of the locks at Stage Left.
And this is a true story. There are like 4 beers left of the beers that you wanted to age. They're so good.
There's a Christmas beer from 5 years ago that, they keep dwindling.
Actually, there's a beer that we have in our cellar. I think we have just a few bottles of it left called
Skaldas Noel.
That beer is, and it does not have one of those champagne caps on it, but it's just got a regular bottle cap.
And like it's about a 7-ounce beer.
It is so freaking good.
And it's like 6 years old now.
Yeah, well, it's like 7 years old now, yes.
It is, it's every year we drink it around Christmas time.
No, well, no, yeah, okay. That's it. I'm done singing.
Thank heaven. So, singing.
But
is that what you call it? Yeah, so the idea of aging beer, listen, this may be a foreign idea to you, and we come in a mass market culture where, you know, we're so concerned with having things fresh and sterile that, you know, mm-hmm. Anheuser-Busch comes out and says, you know, born on dating. Some beer is meant to be drunk fresh. Even some very good beer is meant to be drunk fresh.
Yep.
But let's face it, beer was always a way to preserve things.
Right. They dry-hopped beers. These India Pale Ales came about because they wanted to preserve the beer for long voyages, and so they dry-hopped them.
And the beer ages with time. And listen, here's a little fun fact for everybody. You may not know how beer was invented, but in medieval times, the way that beer was invented was you'd put a couple of pails of water by the fire, and you would throw some grains in it. You'd mm-hmm. throw some you know, a handful of grain in it, and the reason you would do that would be to encourage some low-level fermentation, and it wouldn't be carbonated, but it's still beer because it's from grain, and the reason you did that is because, well,
the water was bad.
Yeah, you want a little alcohol in your water to maybe disinfect it a little bit.
Don't drink the water. It's spoiled.
So if it wasn't for beer, Western European culture as we know it might not even exist. Isn't that just beautiful?
That was so good.
Yeah. Well, you've spent another hour listening to the Restaurant Guys today talking about beer. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. Time is 12 noon.